How synchronicity works. What an amazing subject. We're going to talk with Dr. Kirby Surprise about that. That's right. That's his last name, by the way. That's his original family name, Surprise. And we're going to be talking to him about synchronicity when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Dr. Kirby Surprise with us. Dr. Surprise received his doctorate in psychology in 2007 from the Institute for Integral Studies in San Francisco, a master's in psychodynamic and transpersonal psychology from John F. Kennedy University. He received his license as a psychologist in 2009, currently works in advanced outpatient programs as well. And again, as I mentioned, Surprise is his original name. His book is called How Synchronicity Works. He was back with me about almost five years ago. Kirby, welcome back, doctor. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me back.
Looking forward to this. And yes, your last name is Surprise. What a surprise, right?
Well, surprised about it all my life.
When you were growing up, and you would mention that name, which I think is a powerful name, especially for what you do, the teachers go through that same rigmarole. Is that your real name?
You know, I've gone through that rigmarole from everything from teachers to pizza delivery guys.
I love it. Anyways, let's talk about synchronicity. Let's talk about luck. Let's talk about coincidence. In your opinion, doctor, what is synchronicity?
Synchronicity is a complex thing. It can be used to explain almost any psychic phenomenon. Can I start by giving an example of synchronicity?
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
Here's a joke my father told me, which actually illustrates the point. A man wakes up on his 55th birthday. He looks at the alarm clock, and it's 5:55 in the morning. He grabs the remote, turns on the TV. The Channel 5 news is on. He takes 55 minutes to get dressed, takes the number 5 bus, 5 blocks to his job, gets on the number 5 elevator, goes to the 5th floor. His office is 5th on the left. Now, he's observant, so now he knows something is up. You know, all these 5s, this can't be a coincidence. So he walks into his office, and on his desk, the janitorial staff has accidentally left a racing form. And he goes, oh, this must be a message from God. So he opens it to the 5th horse in the 5th race, and the horse's name is Your Lucky Fives.
I love it.
So he figures he's going to be rich. He calls his bookie. He bets $5,000 on the horse to win. He waits until 5 o'clock in the afternoon, calls his bookie and says, how did my horse do? And the man says, well, he came in 5th.
I knew you were going to say that. I love it.
You know, and as much of a joke as the story is, this stuff really does happen to people. They run into strings of amazing coincidental events, and they often misinterpret them. Now, for our gambler here, my explanation would be that he's having a lot of anxiety about turning 55.
Right.
And that anxiety, that inner process, gets reflected out into the environment and back to him. He has made the classic mistake, though, of thinking that this reflection that he sees of his own thoughts and feelings is an indication of objective reality. You know, that the message is not just inside of him, but that's true in the external world. And, you know, I deal with a lot of delusional psychotic patients, and I wrote the book for two kinds of people. The first is people that are seeing these events and are confused by them, mm-hmm. don't know what's going on, maybe scared by them, think they're abnormal. And the second is people who are lost in their own little delusional systems. And it's sort of a reality-orienting work. And I've been using it with my clients since I last talked to you. And it really does have the ability, if someone's not, you know, genuinely very psychotic, to relieve a lot of apprehension about the way the environment works around them.
Is synchronicity the same as fate?
No, it's not. The problem with some of the concepts like fate is, you know, when you get into fate and free will, these are philosophical questions.
Right.
And I don't really think in that kind of philosophy because I've studied, you know, the science, mechanics, and theories of time a lot because I've had to sort of piece this together, how we perceive time, how physics perceives time, you know, is there a predetermined timeline? And it looks very much, even in the most modern physics, like, you know, fate is an outdated concept. If you're saying there's fate, what you're saying is that 14 billion years ago, there was an event and everything was predetermined by the energy release since then. That's an older model of physics. The newer models of physics are saying that we're living in a vast universe of multiple probabilities, and that the probabilities shift and change, and that nothing is truly, you know, predetermined. Now, as a psychologist, you know, we've seen, for instance, I work in the prison system. Research and statistics are marvelous things. We can, for instance, you know, look at different factors on what would lead a person to be incarcerated. Did they have a two-parent family? Was the income high? Was there drug abuse in the family? Was there mental illness? Do they live in a neighborhood without resources? What's their race? Things like that. And you can actually break down statistically percentages of, you know, what contributes to the outcome. And we can say, you know, with a fair degree of certainty, depending on the conditions a person was raised in, what the probability is that they'll wind up incarcerated or wealthy or any number of factors. But we do have the ability to change that by the choices we make. You know, there's nothing that's purely chance or purely fated, because we kind of can shift the probabilities in our life by what we choose to pay attention to.
Do we make synchronicity happen, or does it happen on its own?
We have a great contributing factor to this. Let me go into the history a little bit about what we know about synchronicity and where the ideas
okay.
come from.
And how you got involved in this, too. I'd like to hear that.
Well, I could start with that if you like.
All right.
So when I was much younger, you know, I was into meditation and spirituality, and I trained myself, for instance, to do lucid dreaming and things that a lot of young people get into and that we learn throughout our lives. When I was an undergraduate, suddenly there was an incredible burst of synchronistic activity around me. You know, I would walk into a room, shelves would fall down, lights would go out, and people would be wondering what's going on. I could walk into a restaurant and place an order, and over the radio, a song would come about the exact order I just placed, all kinds of very, very strange. And I was very panicked by all this, you know, in psychology, there's a symptom called thoughts of reference, which is basically saying, well, if you report that something you thought happened in the environment, or that the environment gave you a message, there's a thought that's referencing the environment. It used to be considered a symptom of something, you know, not necessarily anything particular, but something weird's happening. We need to look into this. So at the time I was an undergraduate psychology student, and, you know, I figured that I'd gone crazy. You know, there's something wrong with me if I'm walking through a world and, you know, TVs and radios talk to you and people give you answers to questions you only asked in your head and things like that. I mean, to my mind, that's delusional material. So in the midst of, like, being completely confused about all this, one day I was taking a friend of mine up to the college to go to a class, and I was going to wait for him outside. It was a fall day in New York, and I parked the car in a parking lot that was sort of nose first into a hillside, and about 50 yards down on the left from this hillside, there was a cottage, and this cottage was used to house visiting faculty. And I was going to wait there for my friend. On the way over, we happened to be joking about our favorite National Enquirer headlines. You know, things like, you know, Pope has alien love child.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we were just laughing, you know, wishing we could get a job like that someday. And one of the stories that we were laughing about was that, you know, there had been a house on Long Island that had been possessed, and during the exorcism, it turned over on its side. We thought that was hysterical. So, you know, I dropped him off, And I'm sitting there, with the windows up and the radio on. And a commercial for the Stephen King movie Carrie comes on. And I think, well, that's interesting. The last couple of scenes of that movie, this teenager who has telekinetic abilities has herself a psychotic break and basically crushes the house into rubble, and that's, how it ends. So being a psychology student, I'm really curious about, how things affect people. And I'm thinking, well, I know people don't move objects, but how would it change you if you could? Our psychologies are based on our physical beings. Our brains are there to process bits of sensory information, and, everything we are is based on you have to get up and cross the room for a glass of water or go out and hunt or go to work. It's not, I'll make it happen and come to me. So I was wondering how your personal psychology would be if you could do it with your mind and the physicality was taken out of it. So I'm looking at this cottage and I'm thinking, wow, what would it feel like to actually be able to make the thing roll over on its side, like in the National Enquirer headline? Wouldn't that be cool? Wouldn't it be great? And as I'm watching this, the building starts to shudder. And no joke, the building rolls over on its side until the roof is facing me. And I got to know what it's like. I was in a complete state of panic because, this is a violation of everything I understood about how reality works. So, I managed to calm myself down. I'm going, well, what's the possible explanations? Did I do this? No. There's never been a good demonstration of telekinesis anywhere at any time. People don't do that. Okay, but the house still rolled over. There it is. Okay, am I asleep? So I've been used to lucid dreaming before, so I have a little checklist in my head, like, what happened just before this? And no, I'm not dreaming. This is real. And yet, I'm still looking at this house that's been turned over. So then I said, okay, if I did that, then I want to see the house crush itself into rubble, just like in the Carrie movie. Immediately, the top of the house begins to cave in. The windows are shattering, 2x4s are coming through the walls, it's crushing in on itself, and I can't even describe the state of like panic I'm in watching this actually happening. And then there's a flash of yellow paint above the house, and this huge bulldozer climbs over the top of the house, finishes crushing it into rubble, and begins loading the wreckage into dump trucks. Jeez. That I couldn't see because the house had been blocking them. It was a perfectly rational explanation for all the events that happened, but they coincided exactly with the internal state I was going through, what I was looking for, what had happened on the radio. Everything was this coordinated sequence, synchronizing my internal process with the events that had been happening on the outside. Now, I had been reading a Carl Jung who said that, these events were caused by archetypes, and because those archetypes were outside of time and space, they were literally, the causes were unthinkable, untraceable, and you would never figure it out. But here, there was a clear link between internal, mental, and emotional processes, the subconscious, and the events on the outside. And I realized that, well, this is thinkable. There is a link to people's inner states, a very direct one. And if that's true, then there is a way to figure out what's actually going on here. So I sort of figured, well, the unconscious probably knows more about this than I do.
Yeah.
And what I'm probably seeing is some partial projection of my unconscious process. So I just asked the unconscious to explain what if this is. And then I followed the pattern and, read the physics that was suggested and the coincidences that led me to this book or that book. And gradually, I came across, a model that said that we're doing this. Because everybody's got an explanation. Jung had archetypes. Some people have their gods, ancestors. People try to say that, synchronicity happens because alien contact is happening. All these different explanations. they turn out to be reflections. So, for instance, most people have seen people who keep a pet bird in a cage. And very often there's a mirror in the cage with the bird. Now, the reason the mirror is there is because the bird's brain is not sophisticated enough to know what a reflection is. Essentially, instead of maintaining two birds, you put a mirror in, and the first bird thinks there's a second bird in the mirror, and then socializes with it, and it keeps him company. Now, there's a test of self-awareness that's, you know, used by people who are into zoology and animals, and it's called the mirror test. And they will put an animal in front of a mirror, and they can tell by whether or not the animal touches himself as he's looking in the mirror, whether or not they get that that's a reflection or not. If they understand it's a reflection, it's a level of self-awareness that most animals don't have. Self-aware animals can include dolphins, elephants, a lot of species of primates, some birds and dogs. Synchronicity is very much the same thing. You know, do you recognize that these events are being caused by your own internal states, by the things that you have focused on? You know, what you're filtering for, the gaps that you're filling in, you know, what you've been concerned with recently. So this is why, you know, it's a mirroring effect.
Is there a science behind it, Kirby?
Yes, there is. There's both neurology and physics. I mean, when you talk about synchronicity, you're always talking about what the internal process of the person is and what the events are that happened around them. Now, the science of it, there's a history. The first part of the history was Carl Jung, who saw these events and said, well, the explanation is there has to be these universal archetypal patterns out there in hyperspace. He called it, you know, a psychoid space. Two of his stories were that, you know, he was researching the fish archetype, and he suddenly had all these synchronicities around fish, you know, ancient inscriptions, people mentioning stuff to him. And he said, well, this must be an example of the fish archetype clustering events around itself, both the people and the external events. He also has a famous example of a woman he's doing therapy with. And this one was like, had this hard kind of Cartesian, unemotional logic about her that he was trying to break through to get to the emotional person underneath. And he just couldn't get there with her. So she was doing a session. He was doing a session with her. And she told him this story about a dream in which there was this scarab beetle, you know, and she kept going on and on about analyzing the significance of it, and he just wanted her to feel something.
Mm-hmm.
So as he's sitting there bored, wondering how he's going to break through, you know, this mask of hers, there's a tapping at the window, a fluttering. So he gets up, he goes to the window and opens it, and there's a really large scarab beetle at the windowsill. So he picks it up, brings it to her and says, well, here's your scarab.
Here you go. Yeah.
Here you go. And, you know, it kind of broke through the pattern for her. Now, in both cases, there's no archetype to be found. You know, he was thinking about fish, you know, and all its mythology and representation. His thoughts created the pattern around him. In the case of the therapy session, it's both of their patterns. It's her dream manifesting as a coincidence at the window, and his desire to break through to her to some emotional level with something she couldn't explain that produces, you know, the bug at the window that, you know, he then uses in the therapy session.
Stay with us, Doctor. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more about synchronicity. Dr. Kirby Surprise with us. His new book is called How Synchronicity Works. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with Dr. Kirby Surprise. His book is How Synchronicity Works. Kirby, intention. Does intention play a part of any of this?
A great deal. So we tend to sort the environment. I mean, what we are evolutionarily is we're pattern matchers. You know, physically, we're obviously not very strong. You know, our teeth and claws aren't worth much.
Right.
What we've done is evolve a strategy where, let me give some background for your listeners.
Okay.
So you're in a very interesting situation right now in the room around you. You have billions of little sensory devices pointed into the environment that are producing digital electrical signals that go to this massive biocomputer in your head, your brain. The brain's purpose is to store these sensory signals, sort through them, and come up with strategies to aid your survival. Now, the first thing it has to do when it does this is delete the majority of the information that's not relevant, and then look at the patterns that are not complete and fill them in. The room around you right now, you're not seeing what's actually out there. What you're seeing is a simulation that's constructed in an area of memory in the brain. So science fiction often almost gets it right. Like Star Trek has holodecks, where you step onto this holodeck and it becomes any environment you want. And then you can tell the computer, delete this, change this, I'd rather see this. The brain is actually doing this for you automatically. You have no direct contact with the outside world. You, the conscious part that you identify as yourself, is about the size of a walnut on the front left area of the brain. You're sort of this auxiliary processing unit that can try to make decisions about things. All your memory information is in the back half of the brain. The front half, the executive function part, selectively calls patterns from memory and compares them, holds seven or eight things together at once, and makes decisions about what the priorities are. So you are always sort of photoshopping the environment. Now, synchronicity is a direct reflection of all these processes. What you're seeing when a synchronistic event happens is something that you have been paying attention to or have been concerned about. This is not just a conscious thing, you know, where I want this to happen. It's more like everything that your brain has been processing, you know, and the brain is very, very active. The Freudians had made the mistake of thinking that the unconscious was sort of this dumping ground. What's actually happening is it's a supercomputer that's constantly working, waking or asleep, processing information, trying to figure out how to help you survive, running simulations about what's happened to you, what the people around you want, how the world works. All of this gets projected forward as synchronistic events in the environment. Now, that's a crazy thing to say, you know, on its surface. You know, the universe obviously is not going to be altered by what any individual thinks all the time. And yet, the synchronistic events happen. Later on in the program, I'll talk about the model that actually has a rational explanation for this.
Okay.
Your question about intent is right on target. The intent is not only conscious, but unconscious. So what you're looking for in the environment is going to cause synchronistic events to reflect back to you. Now, it's not all good. For instance, if someone has experienced a horrible trauma when they're a child, let's say they get molested by a parent. Now, that affects how the child sees their entire reality from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
They know that powerful figures can't be trusted. They are afraid of things. You know, there's a lot of emotional
right.
trauma. And
they're suspicious of everybody.
That happens. That, too, gets projected. So you can wind up with people with paranoid synchronicity events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they think something's out to get them. And the problem with this is these events always reflect back to you what you are already looking for. Now, intent, you can use that. For example, when I first keyed into the fact that these were reflective events, I set up a series of formats I would use to see if I could cause synchronistic events to happen the way I wanted them to happen. The first one I tried was really simple. It was playing a chess game with the environment. So you basically, you know, intend, you look for things related to chess around you. Now, the brain naturally filters things. So you might find, you know, that suddenly you think a lot of events related to chess are happening that haven't been happening. Well, in fact, probably a lot of it has already been there. It's just that you don't remember it. It doesn't have any valence. The brain only remembers things that have an emotional charge on them. We call it a valence charge. So the vast majority of your experience every day is deleted because it's not interesting. There's no valence. When I became interested in seeing chess symbols in the environment, they appear. You know, I met a couple of Mr. Bishops, and advertisements for White Castle come on, and you know, you see the symbols start to show up around you more and more frequently.
More stories about the queen.
Yeah, exactly. Now,
you there? I think we may have lost you, Kirby. We'll try to get you back on here. Let me see if he's there. Are you there, Kirby?
Yeah, sorry.
There you go. I don't know where you went, but you're with us.
So, well, let me continue with what happened with Jung, because it bears directly on this point. Jung didn't believe you could influence the environment. He was very conscious about, you know, his career. He already came up with some ideas that were pretty improvable, and he didn't even come to synchronicity until later in his life. Now, one of his contemporaries was Dr. J.B. Rhine, who was a psychologist at Duke University. Now, one day, a gambler walks into Rhine's office, and he says, "Look, Doc, I know this sounds nuts, but I can influence the way the dice come up." And, you know, Rhine was a real scientist. You know?
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Yeah, he said, okay, show me. So they took out 10 pairs of dice and a notebook. And he said, okay, we're going to do 100 throws of these dice. And I want you to make the number 6 come up more often than average. So they did the run, you know, they did 100 tosses and did the record keeping. And sure enough.
And it should come out, let's see. So they're spinning just one dice 100 times.
No, they're throwing 10 sets. So, you know, altogether 20 dice.
10 sets of 2, okay.
Right, they threw them 100 times and recorded every face as they came up to see, you know, what the average was. And they said the guy had to target the number 6. And it works. You know, the guy comes in about 6% above normal on this. And, you know, Ryan's like, oh, wait a minute, you know, that's not possible. So they did it a couple more times, and sure enough, the guy's hitting 3, 4, 6% above average.
Yeah, which is amazing.
And Ryan becomes obsessed. You know, he designs machines that throw the dice for you so there's no human contact. He, you know, does every conceivable thing to take the, you know, no contact with the dice. He tries coin tosses. He tries all kinds of random stuff, and he's finding that people do this. Is a 3 to 6% change in probability.
Is that what got him into this? Investigations for this?
Yes, that's what, you know, got him into the whole paranormal thing.
And
now, he said, well, you know, let's see if we can find some other things about this. So he tried, one of his first experiments was gamblers versus preachers. You know, he got some ministers and some gamblers and ran them through the dice test to see, you know, if being, you know, spiritual, unquote, had an effect, and he found out there was no difference, you know, for religion or for sort of, you know, moral fortitude to your ability to do this.
Now, were some people better than others?
Marginally. Everybody's got some ability. There's no sort of superhuman people out there, you know, that can do this automatically to a tremendous degree if they're untrained.
And 70% of the time or anything like that.
Yeah. Now, he did find things like he gave people alcohol and made them do the runs, and they weren't as good at it. He gave people caffeine.
That's why Vegas pours it for free, right?
That is actually true. That is actually the reason they do it. You know?
Wow.
They found that caffeine increases the ability a little bit. So he's looking and he's saying, well, brain activity is affected by, you know, stimulants and depressants, something neurological is happening. So here we have a neurological link to an external event. Now, he also tried to find, you know, is there any, like, electromagnetic or pushing and pulling on the dice?
Mm-hmm.
You know, They found no physical forces involved. Then he did something that was really remarkable. He realized that there was a pattern that matched the emotional condition of the clients. So for instance, say people were doing a long set of dice toss. They're doing it 100 times. At the very beginning, the dice will come up on the target fairly consistently above average. Then when you go in about 25% of the runs, it drops to absolute normal average. Then, you know, towards the middle of this long set of dice tosses, the target is suppressed. It's happening less often than average. There's this curve appearing. Then after the midpoint of the experiment, the curve comes back up to average, and towards the end, the ability to influence the target as you want it is even stronger. And he figured out that what's going on is, in the beginning, the person is excited. They're interested. They're paying attention. They want to know if they have this magical power, you know? But after 25 tosses, they get bored. You know, it becomes sort of a drag. You know, here we go doing it again. By the middle of the experiment, they don't really want to do it anymore. You know, they wish they had stopped. The negative emotion suppresses the probability of hitting the target. Towards the end, they get excited again. Wow, I'm going to get to see how I did. What's the outcome? I get to stop throwing these dumb dice for a while. And the ability comes back. And he realized that what he was seeing was that, you know, the ability to affect the dice was following the emotional pattern of the attention and emotion of the subjects.
So if somebody was negative, chances are they wouldn't be as accurate as somebody who is upbeat and positive?
Yes, but you're getting what you want. If you don't want it to happen, you suppress the ability. Now, let's go back to my original story about the house moving. There's no physical energy involved in this. It's not a physical thing. So there's also no sort of limit on the size of the thing that can happen, whether it's a house or a dice on a tabletop. Ryan tried coins. He tried radioactive decay, random number generators. He found this was consistent through everything. Now, what I'm proposing is pretty simple. There's not much you can relate to about a die toss on a tabletop. Not a lot of emotional content there. There is a tremendous amount of emotional valence in the environment around you. Ryan's experiments could not capture complex emotional or cognitive states because you're just looking at numbers on a die. Our environment is constantly bombarding us with information that we make associations to, things that we have emotions about, make judgments about, things that remind us about things that happened to us in the past. You know, we are the universe's greatest supercomputers. You know, the brain in your head has more computational power than every computer on the planet networked together at once. It's vast. And it's operating on the environment and remembering all the emotional nuances of everything that's happened to you and looking for similar patterns. Now, you are actually creating the pattern somewhat in the environment. Now, lest this sound, you know, completely, you know, unnecessary, you got to remember that living organisms always find a way to survive. So our original ancestors, you know, were 100-pound naked people standing on the grassland with a pointy stick, and they were hungry, had to get something to eat. What they were looking at in East Africa, where we all came from, was vast grasslands with the wind blowing an infinite number of intricate patterns across the grass, with the sun creating patterns, cloud shadows, and in that incredibly camouflaged and complex environment were many creatures who themselves had developed their own natural camouflage. Our talent became seeing through the camouflage, okay, looking at the patterns, okay. When do we know we have enough information to throw the spear at this particular shadow?
Right.
And how do we know that that's an antelope and not a lion?
How close, Kirby, is synchronicity from luck? We talked about fate, but what about luck?
You know, we can change events by about, 3 to 6%. Yes, there's some luck in that. The problem with being human is that the environment is so complex that nobody ever figures it all out. Physicists are telling us now that, what we see in the universe is 4% of what's there. Everything else is dark matter and energy. We know it's there. We don't know how it works. We can't detect it. Our lives are like this. We are in the same kind of complex, unpredictable environments that our ancient ancestors were, even with all our technology. And, there is a lot of random. But in that random environment, you have the ability to steer about 3 to 6%, to change things.
So now, that seems to be the percent that this works in.
Yes. Now, we're not vast beings. I like to, think of it like gravitation in some ways. We have a little bit of mass in our bodies and a little bit of influence on everything around us. Not a vast amount. I think that, very sort of overly conservative scientists believe we have no influence. That's wrong. The science I can talk about later, actually, the modern science is saying that, the most important question we're dealing with right now in physics is the fact that when we observe an experiment that changes the events.
Kirby, how would you explain this? I'm in Vegas several years ago with producer Tom, who has been talking to you tonight. And in the middle is some guy, and we're playing blackjack. And we're playing at a special blackjack table that has a wheel that if you get a blackjack and you put a dollar in a little tiny circle, you get to spin the wheel, and it pays up to $1,000. So Tom's playing, I'm playing, and this guy in the middle is playing. I got a dollar in this little circle. I get a blackjack. So we get to have the wheel spun for us. And as the guy begins to spin it, Tom and I are saying to each other, think $1,000, because it pays $1 to $1,000. And we're thinking $1,000, and this thing's clicking along. And the guy in the middle keeps saying, that won't work, nonsense, that won't work. We're watching the wheel. Tom and I, we're thinking again, think $1,000, and it's going click, 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 click. It's getting so close to $1,000, and the guy in the middle continues to say, won't happen. It stops one click away from $1,000. We ended up getting a dollar back. Did that guy affect that with that negativity?
No.
He did not.
Now, here's why. You have to bear with a little bit of explanation here. So the reason why you can affect the environment is not because there's energy coming off of you that's changing things around you. So the big problem with synchronicity and human influence has always been synchronicity shows up in everything. It can be the dice on the table, the way the cigarette smoke rises in your hand, or the way the meteor shower happens. It's like it can be in cosmic events or subatomic events, and it's still following your attention.
Kirby, hold on. We're at the top of the hour already. I want to pick this up when we come right back. Plus, we'll talk more about your work, how synchronicity works, and we'll take phone calls, stories of synchronicity, or questions for Dr. Kirby Surprise when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.